It's a test. It's a test. No, no, it's a podcast. All right, here we are with episode 97 of the Florida Trail Runners Podcast. And this time we've got Robert Sturba on the chat. He's a coach, he's an athlete, and he recently took on the Zion 100 miler out near Apple Valley, Utah. He's done races like Bandera, Run the Rut, and the Long Haul 100. Plus, from a coaching background, you know, we talk about training, we talk about methodologies, nutrition, sweat drip, which actually, you know, the whole sweat drip calculation, you know, that's super crucial, and we get into that a bit. And then we talk about, you know, we talk about running shoes and how his race went down at the Zion 100 this year. So hey, with that, you know, let's kick it off with Robert Sturba and the Zion 100. Hey, hey!
Hey, can you hear me?
Oh yeah.
Right on. How are you?
Oh man, I am doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good.
Definitely excited to be back on again and you know, share any of that knowledge you know, with your fan base and your followers. You know, I've had a couple people reach out and ask like, how was the course and this and that. No, people are like definitely curious about it. And yeah, it was definitely a doozy. So
yeah, and that's the big thing, is just even knowing a course before you even sign up. It's like you see all these pictures, you see a Facebook post, and you're like, oh man, that looks cool. But it's like, I don't know if I could commit myself to traveling all the way out there when like I don't really know the course details, or like, and that's why it's always good to hear from people who actually have like ran the course and actually can tell you from like a relevant perspective of like what's it like out there.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and that's I think some of the like the biggest challenge of like racing abroad or like different races all over the country is like course knowledge of different races and people's experiences with them. You know, like how the aid stations were, how easy it was for crew to get around, what was the course like in this section, that section. You know, those are a lot of questions, like, you know, I think people want answered, you know, before they commit to signing up to a big like destination race or like a race, you know, of like a big distance they, you know, are going to commit and put a lot of effort into. So yeah, I think that's an important aspect to get out for people. So it's kind of cool to like, you know, come from Florida and go experience something different like this, you know, and just kind of just jump into something like out of our element, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess first off, dude, congrats. And like, how are you feeling from Zion?
I bounced back pretty quick. Like the only thing I'd say I'm probably like pretty short on is sleep at the moment. I think after the race finished, you know, I got done just before 5 a.m. on Sunday morning. And, you know, we kind of hung out there for a little bit, you know, picked out my buckle, and then we ended up driving back to the Airbnb, which is like 20 minutes away, got a shower and like maybe a 2 hour nap. And then we got back up and like came back down to start finish line to watch some more people finish. And then we basically, you know, slept that night very short and had to drive to Vegas the next morning, fly home all day flying, you know, didn't sleep really much on the plane. And then, you know, the kids and everything back to school on Tuesday morning, and, you know, back into work Wednesday and Thursday. So haven't had a full day to sleep in yet and like, you know, not wake up to an alarm. Got a little earlier wake up this morning, and I think everybody did in Florida with that test alert or whatever. So I was sleeping pretty good up until that, and then I was like, really? So yeah, hopefully this weekend I get caught up on sleep. But as far as the body goes, starting to feel pretty good. Quads and calves definitely, like, you know, the course took its toll on those, especially coming, you know, from Florida, not being on that terrain all the time. But even that, like, I'm kind of impressed with the turnaround so far. And I just contribute that to like diet and nutrition, you know, as far as how quick I recover. If you want, we could dabble a little bit more into that later or now. But been like a big, like, mind blowing factor for me, like, to just be able to bounce back after some of these so quickly.
Yeah, the training aspect is always like the biggest part of it, like especially with recovery. But, you know, I guess, you know, we ought to kick it off with, you know, an introduction. You know, what's your background? You know, what's that running history?
Yeah, so I guess I've probably been running ultras for, or I guess running for maybe the last seven or so years. So like my family's always been like, you know, into running, especially like, I think my sister was the first to get into it. Then my brother started like getting into it with her, and they ended up doing a marathon together. And I kind of grew up playing like somewhat competitive hockey growing up. So I was still fairly like active, you know, through my high school and college years. And then I just got kind of like busy with work there for, you know, 4 or 5 years being an automotive technician. And, you know, I wasn't really much into, you know, anything too active until I went to one of my brother and sister's marathons. I think they did the Donna up there in Jacksonville. And I don't know, just being kind of part of the environment up there, I got kind of like, I guess, running curious. And soon after that, my wife's work put on a 5K. I'm like, okay, I'm going to like get some shoes and kind of train for this and see if I can, you know, maybe we'll do a 5K. So kind of just started out from that. And got a little hooked into it, you know, started getting more serious, like bought a watch and shoes and stuff from the Running Elements had just opened up. So they were like good families. So it kind of spiraled into this like, okay, I guess I'm going to do some running now. So started like working my way up half marathon, marathon. So did a couple marathons. And after that, I had an opportunity to actually jump on with the Running Elements as like a buyer, or I guess the manager at first. I'm now the buyer, but I was kind of looking to make a career change. I was getting kind of burnt out of working in a hot shop all year outside here in Florida, working on cars. And I had a business background, like a business degree and a little bit of a business background. So I was like, hey, you guys, if you ever need any help, let me know. And Juan and Katrina hired me up there, the Running Elements, as their manager. And I progressed over time here now as a buyer. And I do all the retail buying for them now. And we have grown the store up a little bit. And we've moved up to One Daytona and have, you know, a pretty good thing going up there. And it just kind of like fueled my running addiction over the years and kind of progressed into some trail ultras, you know, because with that, I guess progression of running, I got a little curious about coaching and started helping my friend and running together with a friend here locally, just training for like a 50K or 50 mile race. And I think it was Dark Sky 50 mile race up in Tennessee she was training for. And you know, we're kind of putting the miles in together, and I was like, well, hey, maybe I'll sign up last minute. And I ended up signing up. And that was technically my first ultra up in Tennessee, the Dark Sky 50. And from there, it was just, I pretty much got hooked after that. So been like a pretty big part of my life here over the last 3 or 4 years. So trying to run full time, you know, be the buyer full time of the Running Elements. And I'm dabbling in and kind of building a small coaching business with the running, trying to share some of the knowledge I've learned over the years and kind of shorten the learning curve for, you know, people in the community. Cause that's what I find is the biggest hurdle of a lot of these races is being able to shorten the learning curve. Like you put in a lot of time and effort, and it's nice to have like a sounding board as a coach, you know, to kind of like suss some things out, you know, progress a little bit faster than you may have without a coach. So I really got into that after I hired myself a coach. So maybe about 3 years ago, I reached out to Jeff Browning, and I was lucky enough to get on his roster, and I'm still on his roster today. So he's my coach. I've learned a ton from him, and just trying to like trickle down all that knowledge to the athletes, you know, that I coach in the community here. So.
Yeah, actually, you know, how did you actually get into coaching?
Well, when I was working at the Running Elements, like, we were doing like, you know, as I was working at the Running Elements, we were working with, you know, the community and stuff like that. And we wanted to put on like some of these like, you know, nightly run clubs and some stuff for runners. So I was just curious to learn more. So we jumped into the RRCA coaching program. So I jumped in that mainly to learn more knowledge for myself on how to coach and just like, I guess, learn more so I could like coach myself essentially. But then, you know, as I jumped on with Jeff for coaching, I kind of like, I don't know, felt like this could be translated down to some people in our community. And I just really like helping grow the running community. And like I said, be that like sounding board and knowledge source for people to, you know, take the knowledge I've learned and apply what bits and pieces can help them in their running future. And, you know, more and more people just kind of started reaching out, and I'd be answering questions, and I was like, well, maybe we could write some training plans and like kind of got it all kind of streamlined now, covering like diet, nutrition, training plans, strength and mobility work, kind of like a whole package of, you know, kind of everything you need to be to like grow your running future. And it's kind of snowballed from there. And it's just been like this organic, you know, movement and growth. And it's been kind of a really fun, positive thing to be involved with. So
now is there a training philosophy that you like or some kind of methodology?
Yeah. I mean, I stick to like Phil Maffetone type heart rate training for most of it. And like, you know, the 80-20 rule. So, you know, like 80% of your runs are going to be at like that, you know, easy conversation pace. And then like, you know, as you, you know, run injury free, then for, you know, a certain amount of time, we could start sprinkling in some speed work, you know, 1 to 2 workouts a week, you know, kind of build your running economy and your aerobic base, you know, by sprinkling in those workouts. So, and yeah, everything's kind of custom based on like the lifestyle and like of the client and how often they can get out. And so we kind of get creative with that too and how busy you're working. But yeah, the main thing is sticking to like the Phil Maffetone heart rate. And that's sometimes a tough thing for runners at first because we all want to go out and run fast. So if you're not familiar with Phil Maffetone heart rate training, it's typically like you take 180 beats per minute and you subtract your age from that. And then if you've been running injury free for like the last 2 years, I believe it is, you can add like 5 beats per minute to that. So I typically like my, and then I'll give you your heart rate ceiling. So my typical heart rate ceiling for like my easy runs that I don't let my heart rate really go over is like right around 149, 148, somewhere in there. So 80% of my runs are going to be underneath that heart rate ceiling. And then when I sprinkle in speed work and stuff like that, I still have like a 20-minute warm-up, and then I start my speed section. And within that speed section, my heart rate's a little past that heart rate ceiling, like I said, to help grow aerobic capacity and build your ability to gain some more running economy and stuff like that. And then the rest of the, you know, run through that speed section for like 20 minutes in that workout and leave, you know, 10, 15 minutes for cool down. But like I said, depending on the runner and the experience and stuff like that, we run anywhere from like 1 to 2 speed workouts a week.
Yeah. So if I'm 27, so I would have, I think, 153 or something like that.
Yep. And if you've been running injury free for, you know, the last couple of years, you can add like 5 beats per minute to that. And another thing with that heart rate ceiling too, is kind of important for ultra runners is once you're above that heart rate ceiling, you got to think of your body as having like 2 fuel tanks. And, this is why I tell people this is important to pay attention to, especially in ultras, because myself included have a tendency of going out too fast. And if you go out too fast and that heart rate spikes above that ceiling right away, you're going to go straight to burning glycogen, which is one of your fuel tanks. That fuel tank only holds, you know, about 2000 calories worth of energy, you know, that we get from like, you know, a little bit of carb loading before a race. And then our other fuel tank is our fat stores. And even the leanest person on the planet holds upwards of like 20,000 plus calories of onboard fat. So that's a much longer sustainable kind of a bonk proof type fuel tank. So typically people that go out too fast, if they're not getting enough glycogen back in, form of gels or, you know, carbohydrates, we hear about that dreaded bonk, you know, and you're doing the death march into the finish. So starting out, you know, sometimes slow and easy with that low heart rate keeps you or gets that fat burning rock kind of warmed up and you burning onboard fat super efficiently. So when you do start to push it, like maybe the second third of the race, you know, you're not depleting your glycogen as fast, and or at least not faster than you're able to replace it, like your gut's able to tolerate replacing it. And you kind of become bonk proof with that type of approach.
See, this is what I always find interesting, you know, but from coach to coach to a different kind of coach, like you've got a lot of different methodologies, different kind of theories on how to train from, you know, Jack Daniels, Galloway, Arthur, yeah. Lennard, however you say it.
Lydiard. It's probably more Lydiard way is kind of, I'd say, the closest I'd probably follow. So,
yeah. And then like, there's like the Igloi method, but that's like all short interval training with like a heavy focus on the heart rate. It's always interesting like how coaches have like a hybrid or they kind of stick to one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the just for ultras, it depends on the type of race too and like what you're training for. So there's like race specific stuff that you can apply. But I just think for like some of the longer ultra races, you know, having that ability to like control your heart rate so you don't deplete your glycogen too fast is found to be fairly important. So
yeah, and also kind of looking at training too, because you know you talk about the full spectrum of training. How does the mental aspect of like how someone's feeling, how does that play a role?
I think the biggest thing sometimes is burnout, I guess, if that's what like you're referencing as far as like mental capacity and stuff like that, because you have to find the balance with the athlete too, and like what they're capable of handling. You know, it depends on the home life, their work life. So you have to kind of balance those things, you know. And I have some athletes that will tolerate, you know, 60 to 75 miles like peak out week, you know, because they have a little bit more time to put in the running. But I also have like very successful runners that, you know, run like 40 to 50 miles a week, but may do a little bit more like strength workouts at their desk or something like that during the day, you know. So it's all kind of dependent on the person. You do have to find that balance to where you're, you know, still enjoying it, and like it's not a heavy stressor to get out and get your run, kind of a thing.
Yeah, because I remember one time, so when I was getting coached by Pat Reagan, the workout was like 1,000s, 800s, and some 200s tossed in there, and
right.
Knocked out the 1,000s, no problem. Then I hit the 800s, and I just did terrible. Like mentally, I hate the 800. I just don't do well with it.
Yeah.
And so it looked horrible on the splits, and then boom, 200s came and gone. And I told him, like, look, man, I hate the 800. I'm not in the zone mentally. I hate it. Yeah. I don't like it. And he's like, all right, we're doing 600s then.
Yeah. And I think there's wiggle room with that with every athlete, you know, on what they kind of like and where they can run and stuff like that. You know, some speed workouts is definitely good, like I said earlier, to like build your running economy and like increase your leg turnover. But you know, sometimes it can just be as simple as doing like one workout a week where you're doing some just easy strides, you know, like easy 50 minute run and like warm up for 20 minutes. And at the 20 minute mark, you do, you know, a 15 to 30 second stride where you're at like a 6-7 RPE, you know, you're pushing, like you're gradually increasing over that 15 or 30 seconds. And then once that 30 seconds is done, you like slow back down into that easy pace again until you get to like the next 5 minutes, and you do another one, and you do like four or five of those within a run, you know. And that again helps leg turnover and running economy. There's another good book. I'm probably going to forget the name, but it has some really good information in there on variable paced running. It's important to like surge and sprint occasionally and then come back down in speed. That just helps work different muscle groups and, eventually adding speed. And like I said, it could just be as simple as throwing in like an easy strides workout a week. It doesn't need to be like, you know, huge, like you said, 800 meter repeats or 400 repeats or anything like that. So
yeah, now that you say that, that reminds me of when I ran in college for St. Leo down here in Florida. You know, anytime we would do a tempo run, I'd just bonk out. I'd do horrible. I was not good at the tempo run. But when we would do a progression run, oh man, it was awesome. I would do great for the progression run. So what the coach did, you know, on the tempo days, you know, when the rest of the team is doing the tempo, I'm doing like a mini progression run, you know, 5 seconds here, 10 seconds here, 5 seconds here, just that mini progression, because like, you know, mentally for myself, you know, I was still in the hunt. You know, I was still in the game. I was still focused on doing my best. And, you know, I was mentally in it.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the runner and the race. So just an example of that, like Jeff and I have, my coach, have figured out over the years that like some of these, like I use Bandera as an example this year, and I think it's kind of where it finally clicked. Just because I've run Bandera the last 3 years and I've somehow progressively gotten slower every year. But we were trying to figure that out and like why that is. And one thing specifically is like terrain. I don't get that terrain to train on here. And like my first lap of that race, for those that don't know, it's a 2-lap 50K course. The first lap is always pretty decent, but I like fully fall, I wouldn't say fall apart, but I have a way slower second half. And it's not that like my body can't hold up to it, but it's just like the mental capacity it takes to be able to like run on that terrain I think takes its toll on me, and I just start like kind of checking out. And once I start checking out and not focusing as much on the terrain, you know, in order to survive on that technical course, I have to slow down. So one way we've kind of like figured out how to, you know, grow that like mental focus and capacity is I found like a hill route here near my house where, you know, instead of doing like interval runs, we've just like turned it into like, I'll do like 4 by like 10 minutes with like 3 minute float in between on this hill circuit. And I just run this like figure eight. You know, you have to be like super on and focused for this, you know, 10 minutes. And then you get like 3 minutes recovery in between. And then after I run that, like, you know, 4 or 5 intervals on that, like I take like a 15 or 20 minute cool down and I end at the base of the hill and I just do sprint repeats up this, like 30 second sprint repeats up this hill, you know, 5 or 6 times. And then I have like an easy cool down mile to the house. And that I think has started to really help just like that mental engagement on some technical terrain, because this hill circuit kind of bobs and weaves and moves back and forth and you're like up and down and dip in. So you have to be mentally engaged. And so I think once we've started to add that and fix that in, I felt that it really translated well to running out here in Zion. So that's been a piece that we've just had to kind of like figure out over the years, how do we get someone from Florida that doesn't have this terrain to train on all the time? Like, what's the best we can do there to get you ready for this race here? And, like we talked about, it's all different for the runner and like the terrain they're going to run on and what they've got to work with back at home.
Yeah. Yeah. Mental engagement. It's like the hidden thing. That's so important though.
It is. And that's like the biggest thing, I think to get ready for, because I mean, Zion, it's some very technical parts, especially on top of the mesas, you're just kind of like bobbing and weaving and trying to follow these like little white dots on top of the rocks for the navigation. So you're constantly like scanning and like, oh wait, I gotta turn here, there's the flag, the paint mark's over there, I gotta go that way. So it's like you're constantly mentally engaged. We're here sometimes on my long runs, you know, I run out of door sleeper a lot, I could just kind of like chill and like kind of zone out, and sometimes that's not good. So when you have to be like mentally focused for a whole race. So
yeah, so earlier you mentioned the recovery thing, because I know I definitely wanted to come back to that and like how you bounce back from a race. And I've always heard that like your recovery process is like based off of the prep that you put in for that race.
Yeah, for the most part. So I eat, probably call it more of like a primal type diet. With that, I don't eat any like sugar, grains, seed oils are kind of like the main things that I don't eat, or any kind of like processed carbohydrates. So no like pizza and beer and pasta and stuff like that for like my carbohydrates. And with that, I eat like a higher protein diet. So I'd say my food pyramid is probably a little unconventional or more like carnivore type maybe. So like the bottom part of my food pyramid is primarily like animal-based protein. So I eat a lot of like eggs, red meat, fish. And I get my main carbohydrates from like fresh fruits. So I eat like a lot of bananas, a lot of strawberries, berries. I do dates a lot, mango. And that's raw honey is another big one that I get like carbohydrates for. If I want a little like pick me up before like a speed workout early in the morning, I'll do like a spoonful of honey. And then I do some root veggies. And then the, you know, tippy top of my food pyramid would probably be like leafy greens or vegetables. Like I don't focus on them too much. I try to get most of my nutrients from like the meats and whatnot. I do eat like organ meats and stuff like that too, so I do try to eat, I wouldn't say nose to tail, but like I do get like these liver, I eat liver a lot, and sometimes like chicken heart and stuff like that, and a really good like nutrient dense well-sourced fresh farm eggs, and that's where I get like most of my nutrients from. And instead of eating like 400 to 500 or even 1,000 grams of carbohydrates a day, like I eat, I guess I would say lower carb. So if you guys, anybody like Zach Bitter or Jeff Browning, Nick Curry, most of them are kind of like the pioneers in this style of nutrition. And so I guess on a low, easy day where I just maybe have a recovery run or like a rest day, I'll probably eat, you know, 50 grams of carbohydrates versus like a day I have a long run, I may eat like 200 to 250 grams of carbs. So still fairly low in carbohydrates, but again, high in protein. I'll eat anywhere from 80 to 100% of my body weight in grams of protein a day. So I try to shoot for like 130 to 140 grams of protein a day. And like I said, most of that coming from high quality, like animal sources. And what that has really done for me is just, one, I've like really like leaned up, but been able to maintain some muscle mass. But with the lack of, or the restriction of carbohydrates or the lower carbohydrates, it really just helps keep oxidative stress down and inflammation. And I think that's been the biggest thing that gets me to recover the quickest is just the lower carb, so less inflammation. I have less joint pain. And after Zion, I had like no feet or ankles whatsoever. So it's been like kind of mind blowing because the first like couple hundred mile races I did, like I didn't necessarily eat this way. I guess I ate more like American standard diet, and I'd be wrecked for like 2 to 3 weeks after these races and like ton of inflammation. Like, but now like after the race, I'm doing like air squats in the parking lot, or like we're hooking up our travel trailer the next day and we're driving down the road to the next campsite, or I'm like out playing with the kids or something like that. Like, I'm not like totally wrecked, which is the biggest like mind blowing part of it. So,
yeah, you know, maybe that's the thing I need to fix, you know, stop, you know, cut back on the beer and cut out some of that pizza.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to do. And like, I definitely indulge. And I, you know, tell my athletes, like, once you go through like a little, like I have everyone kind of go through like a keto reset, where it's like a 30-day challenge, where you kind of like get rid of the sugars and the carbs, and you become like, you force yourself to metabolically burn fat as fuel on the daily basis. So once you eliminate carbohydrates, your body becomes less dependent on it. There's a little period of time where you go through that you're like, oh man, this really sucks. I'm hungry right now. I'm kind of angry, like very temperamental and short tempered. But your body, as you present like healthy fat and like, you know, good amounts of protein, your body starts to open up that metabolic pathway of burning onboard fat as fuel, like in your daily life. And you kind of lose that hangry feeling, you know, and you're not as hungry as much. You're not craving sugar anymore. And like, once you get past that, and you're, like I said, that pathway to burn onboard fat as fuel is opened, we start bringing carbohydrates back in the form of like, you know, root veggies and fruits and honey and stuff like that. But we do it strategically around workouts to basically keep, you know, blood sugar stable. So you don't ever really snuff out your body's ability to tap into your fat stores as fuel. And I think that's the biggest thing. So once you have that metabolic flexibility to pull from both of those fuel tanks, that's when you kind of become bonk proof in a race. And when you're pulling like more fat as an energy source during a race, you have to push less carbohydrates, which again translates to less oxidative stress on your body. It means basically your mitochondria is not working as hard, and it's not kicking out as much inflammation, which is probably the sole reason why like recovery is so good. Because I'd say I won't say non-fat adaptive runner, because I think some runners are all somewhat fat adapted, but a well fat adapted runner, I can say for my only push in a race like Zion, maybe 180 to 200 calories, 220 calories per hour, versus someone that quite as efficient as burning onboard fat as fuel may have to push 300 to 500 calories per hour to not bonk. That makes like a big difference in the end as well. Because you're not, your stomach also doesn't have to digest 300 to 500 calories per hour, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, kind of with food and kind of circling back to what you said earlier with working for running Elements, you know, I used to work for Fit to Run, and I used to love this, like the shoe science and the science of shoes and actually wearing the right shoe. Right. Does that play a role in kind of in the training cycle?
Yeah, I think finding the right thing for everything, like finding the right nutrition is important, the right shoes important, the right gear is important for certain races. So yeah, depending on your run gait and stuff like that and the type of terrain you're running on, I think it's another important thing to be like in the right and correct shoe for you and your gait for sure.
Yeah, because I always found it interesting like how Nike has the React Foam, Brooks has a DNA Loft, they've got the DNA right. Amp, Saucony has their Power PB, which is basically a better version of the Adidas Boost Foam, and then you know, on from there it's all a different form of like EVA.
Right, and they're all fairly similar. They do it all a little bit differently. Like foam preference kind of comes down to what they prefer and what type of road feel or responsiveness they want out of a shoe. So that's why at the store we carry so many different ones, because everyone's kind of like feels going to be a little bit different, and everybody's foot shape is different too. So like when people come in, we want to look at their foot and see how it fits. Well, I guess the best way to describe it is the different way shoes are built, and they're all built on like different lasts. And a last is basically like a mold that the shoe is kind of built around. And that last is based on different feet shapes. And you want to find the right last for your foot, because you don't want to be like falling off the platform because your foot's a little too wide, or you don't want to be like sliding around too much in it, because then you may lose some stability. So it's important to find the right like fit for your foot, and you know, something that complements your running gait, because everybody runs a little bit different. Like we all have our natural gait, and it's not to say like one gait's like, you know, correct or incorrect. It's just we all run the way we run, but it's important like match the shoe to that. So
yeah, because that's the big thing, because I remember, you know, working in the running store, you have a lot of people who are either chasing the fad or what's on sale, but like what you put on your feet, it definitely does matter. So I guess for folks who maybe don't know or never went to a running specialty store, you know, how do you figure out, you know, what's the best way to figure out what is the shoe they should choose?
Like I said, it kind of depends on their feet. So like our process is just to ask them kind of questions like, what are you wearing now? And then what kind of mileage are you doing per week? What terrain are you running on? And then we'll ask, do you have any aches or pains or issues that you're dealing with? And then from there, we also have a foot scan machine. So we'll get them on a foot scan machine and take a look at their feet, so we can kind of tell what last or what, you know, their foot shape is, if they have high arches, low arches. And then we typically either watch them walk up and back, or we'll get them on a treadmill and watch them run. And from there we kind of piece together all those questions into the, you know, we'll probably end up pulling three or four shoes out of like different foams, but all like of the same type of support or same kind of like cushioning feel that they may like. And it's just a matter of sometimes of trying on those three or four to figure out which one you like the most.
Yeah. And I guess speaking of shoes, what'd you wear out at Zion?
I've been wearing Ultras for the last, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, but I've been back and forth on the trail between the Mont Blanc and the Temp 4. I like the Mont Blanc, but it's more of a like straight, I wouldn't say straight line shoe, but it's a little harder to run in technical terrain because the upper material doesn't hold you so tight to the platform. So I find with that shoe, sometimes if I'm in technical terrain, I'll roll my foot a little bit more. So I chose to run in the Temp 4 for this race. So it just has a little bit more structure in the upper and holds me to that platform a little bit tighter. So with all the loose terrain and rocks and stuff like that, like I said, I'm able to be held to that platform a little bit, and it just makes my ankles a little bit more stable.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
But I guess kind of moving into Zion, you know, you have the diet, the training, you know, you got the shoes, you know, how did you even decide on picking the Zion 100?
I don't know. Like my family and I like to travel quite a bit. So we've always like tried to pick races with places we've kind of wanted to go. And we haven't been kind of to the like desert area, Arizona, Utah area. So I was like, friend of the store ran, you know, the Zion 100 a couple of years ago. And I like just remember like hearing his story about it. I'm like, man, that sounds kind of cool. I think maybe one day I want to sign up for that. And like, I think I tried to sign up for it in 2022, but it was like such a big like backlog of people from like COVID, like rolling over. So I wasn't able to get in that. And, you know, I just, as soon as it opened up this year, I'm like, you know, I think I'm signing up for Zion. And we just kind of went for it. Yeah, just kind of made it like a big family vacation to go out there and like check out Zion. And we like hung around St. George and went up to like Snow Canyon and climbed in some lava tubes. And like I said, kind of made a fun family vacation out of it. And yeah, I heard it was tough and technical and a challenging course. So that was also like icing on the cake, you know, I was up for a challenge. So
yeah, and kind of with that, you know, obviously because you have the coaching background, did you have a game plan coming into this race?
A little bit, yeah. So typically for, you know, any 100-mile race, I always kind of want to run, you know, the first third, you know, relatively easy and relaxed. I don't want to be pushing anything the first third. And then depending on how I feel in the second third kind of dictates how hard I'll push. You know, I think with races like this, it's, you know, and like not knowing the course necessarily, other than like what my coach Jeff told me about, is never fighting anything like too early in the race. And I sometimes have a problem of like feeling too good too early and ended up pushing too hard too early. And then, you know, by the time I get to like mile 70, I'm like hurting way more than I need to be. To be like cranking on any kind of decent time. So I just told myself I was going to, you know, just for sure this race, I'm going to run, you know, super relaxed the first third. And I felt like I did that for the most part. I did roll through one of the aid stations at mile 25. And my son was like, you only got like 11 more people to pass. And then they're all like high-fiving and there's a bunch of energy there. And I got kind of like jazzed up, kind of leaving that aid station. And then as soon as I got out of there, I was like, I need to slow down a little bit and ease up, which I was able to. But I don't know. I guess the biggest thing, like I said, is like not knowing the course and like what's ahead of you necessarily, because you don't want to, again, come out too fast and not have legs to handle what you may encounter later in the course. And I think some of that just comes in time with like running a specific course over and over again. But like talking with my coach, we felt like, you know, I could maybe be, you know, in the top like 15 or 20 or so. So I did a little research and like looking like normally right around 20 hours wins this race. And I've always kind of felt on this type of course with this amount of climbing, I maybe had like a, you know, on a good day, like a 21, 22 hour like effort in me, but you know, that didn't happen, but I still had like a pretty good race, all things considered. So yeah, I guess the plan, like you said, is just kind of like my plan's always like take the first third easy, like don't fight anything in the second third, but if it's like feeling good, let it go. And then the last third, I typically just try to like give everything I've got in the last third of the race.
Yeah, and kind of with the course, you know, because like here in Florida, you know, we're a high humidity state. And I know a lot of people when they're thinking about races like this, they're like, oh, you know, it's hot, the air is dry. You know, what's the air actually like out there? Or is that something, you know, you didn't really worry about?
It is something I definitely worried about for sure. And, you know, something I've been dialing into is like hydration and like my sweat dump rate in different like climates and temperature and stuff like that. So the big trick with this race is it's so dry out there. So genetically, every person like dumps a certain amount of sodium per liter of fluid. And that's, you know, they have test precision hydration where you can get tested. Or you could, you know, through trial and error, you can kind of figure out how much sodium you need to replace per liter of fluid. So I figured out that I'm right around 1176 milligrams of sodium per liter of fluid. So with that, then I need to know how much like sweat I'm dumping every hour is kind of how I kind of like log it. And like in these temperatures here in Florida, I dump just under a liter of fluid per hour. But out there, it's so dry that you don't really get like sweaty. Like as soon as you sweat, it's basically dry with you right away. So sometimes it's easy to get like easy to back off on hydration because you're like, I'm not sweating all that much. Like I don't need this much fluid. So trying to still like pay attention to that was like a big piece of this race. And I did end up finding myself getting a little behind on hydration at one point, and I had to like chug a bunch of water and add a bunch of sodium. So yeah, I guess in Florida here, I kind of practice and I'll like weigh myself before a run and like not consume any water in like 80 something degree temperature. Come back and weigh myself to see how much, like towel off and weigh myself and see, see how much sweat I dumped per hour. And then in a race like this, I basically then know my drink rate. I want to drink about a liter of fluid per hour. And with that, I want about 1100 milligrams of sodium.
Dang, yeah, that's see, like that stuff like that is just super interesting.
Yeah, it gets a little technical and it like sounds super complicated, but honestly, it's like once you get it like figured out for yourself personally, it's like the simplest regimen to follow. So like I do like a scoop and a half of scratch in one bottle, like 500 milliliters and 500 milliliters of water in the other bottle, and I try to roughly consume that once every hour, and that'll give me about with that and a Humagel per hour gives me about like 200 calories an hour, 220 calories an hour, gives me about 1,000 milligrams of sodium and a liter of fluid. And then from there, that's like kind of like my base nutrition, and I can make like small tweaks off of that. So once you have like a base nutrition regimen figured out, it's like I set a timer on my watch for every hour just to like alarm. So as soon as that alarm goes off, I kind of look at my bottle, see where I'm at. Oh, I'm a little behind, or oh, I'm already out. Like the next aid station's up here, I'll be able to replenish. So it gets kind of like super simple once you get it kind of like figured out. But after that, it's just like it's so regimented and easy. Like you don't even have to think about nutrition. And it's really become super simplified for me, and something I don't necessarily need to think about a whole lot during the race, which is take some of the stress out of it. Because I know nutrition is a big thing, like during a race that some ultra runners do struggle with. So.
Well, that probably makes sense why when I did my first marathon, I was told to take a gel every 4-ish miles.
Yeah, that can be a lot sometimes for the gut to tolerate. So.
But I guess coming into race day, because I've never been out there. I don't even know what it's like out there. What's it like out there, on race morning?
Well, we started pretty, I think it started at 5, so it's pretty dark. And we went down this like dusty dirt road to get there. So everything's like dusty and it was quite cold. I think it was like 30, 35 or something, or 34 at race start. So yeah, I don't know. I always like starting ultras in the dark because everyone's in their headlights and everyone's all kind of like cuddled around the start line trying to stay warm and stuff like that. So it's always like a really fun experience. And I guess right off the gate, we just, like I said, started in the 30 degree weather. And
Yeah, so take me into those early miles, because I know, because I read up on the course a little bit. You start out climbing up the Flying Monkey Trail to the Mesa. You've got the Dalton Wash, a creek crossing. How'd those miles go down?
So we started start finish. Just a little bit about the course we run up. It's kind of like a fire road or service road for like the first 5 miles until you get to the first like Goosebump aid station. And then from there, basically the race is broken up with all these different aid stations. As you get to the each aid station, you kind of run a loop out on top of a mesa. So the mesa loops are anywhere from like, 5 to, I think the longest one was 7 miles long. So you're running like pretty runnable terrain in between the mesas. Some of it is kind of undulating like up and down, but it's like fairly runnable and not too technical. And then on top of each one of the mesas, it kind of gets a little more technical and a little more navigational dependent. Like you're trying to, like I said earlier, like spot these flags, or like they had like little white dots spray painted on the rocks that you had to kind of follow. And if you could envision like if someone took like a hose that pumped out like concrete and he's just like spraying it everywhere. And it's just kind of like really flowy and spilling everywhere and not really organized, and then it all just like hardens. That's kind of like what the top of the mesas are like. So it's kind of like up and down and got these dips and nooks cut out and stuff like that. So you're definitely like working and like bobbing and weaving and dancing up there a little bit to kind of like find your way, through the mesas. I'm trying to look at the map now too to remember all the names of everything. So Goosebumps, the first aid station. Like I said, it's fairly runnable up to that. So that's mile like 5.2. And then you kind of do a loop out on that Goosebump Mesa, and that that loop was, I think, probably about 12 miles long altogether. And then once you got back to that aid station, there was like a real technical descent down a mesa, like loose rock and just like super steep and kind of slidey. And that was probably for about a mile. And then from there, you kind of get into the lower, I wouldn't necessarily call it desert, but maybe I would call it the desert. And it's more like rolling single track until you get to mile 25 at Virgin Desert. And Virgin Desert's a really nice aid station. It's like fully loaded. And then after you leave there, you're on like that same rolling, like single track for a little while. But then, like you said, you start climbing up to like Hurricane Rim and Virgin Dam. And it's like a pretty steady climb there. And like, I'd say slightly technical, but not anything that's like too loose or trippy, but it's still pretty challenging because it's not all necessarily runnable. So you're mixing it up between like running and power hiking quite a bit. And that's another thing I like practice quite a bit in training is like power hiking. I'm not so sure a lot of athletes like spend time on actually hiking. They just run. So it's been like a skill that I've been able to hone over the years and slowly get better at. That I think definitely plays a big role in still moving efficiently across the ground when you're hiking. But once you leave like Virgin Dam, you get to like Sheep Bridge, which is another just like water only station. And then you kind of come back into town there. I think it's on like 19. It's like the main road that takes you up to Zion Park. And you run on the road there for a real steep climb after that up to Smith Mesa. And that's just like this endless, like it felt like it was endless. Like road climb, which is kind of nice because it's not like it's a climb, but you're not like also focusing on like rocks and boulders and stuff like that. You're just kind of like locked in the climb, on the road. And I want to say it's about 1500 feet of gain in about a mile or maybe just a little over. So you're at that point of the day, like the sun's out, that laser beam is just like on you and you're like fully exposed. There's like no shade whatsoever on the course. So trying to stay like damp is kind of hard. So I'd be like squirt myself with the bottle here and there just to kind of keep myself wet and cool. Cause like I said, there's not a whole lot of shade, but again, that road kind of connects you to another aid station, Smith Mesa. And once you get up to Smith Mesa, you do another big, I think it was, it's another six mile loop on top of a mesa up there. And that kind of got like soft and like rooty and like tacky mud. You know, that like tacky mud that kind of like sticks to like the bottom of your feet. So like you're kind of like running through that stuff and it's kind of like trampled by like horses and cattle and stuff like that. So it's kind of more of like a hard packed, holy like horse trail, I describe it. So it doesn't look that bad, but it kind of sucks a little bit out of your legs, especially after you just had that climb up there. You know, you kind of descend down into Virgin BMX then. So you're coming up off that mesa, but it's super technical drop down into Virgin BMX. There's actually one section that they had laid a rope in that you had to like rappel down like 8 feet. And I was like, wait a minute, seriously? Like down by a rope down to this next ledge down here? Like my kids are down there at the aid station. I surely hope I don't like slide into the aid station, you know? So that was kind of cool though. It was kind of like that was kind of unknown. And then from Virgin BMX, you hit Virgin BMX twice, but you hit it at 50 coming down off that mesa. And then you go out to Guacamole, which is another mesa. So you do a big loop on the mesa and you come back to Virgin BMX. And then from Virgin BMX, you head back to do that same technical climb that had that big descent in the beginning after we left Goosebump. So now we got to climb back up to Goosebump and we run through that aid station for the third time. That climb in the middle of the night, it was just getting dark as I was like heading into that climb. And I was, you know, feeling pretty toasty by then. Like my quads were sore. Like I was getting, you know, a little tired. And that climb just kind of like seemed like it took forever. But once I got to the top of Goosebump there, I had a couple more miles back to start finish. And you come to start finish at like mile 80. So once you get up to that climb, it's like 5 miles of runnable like road. And then I got to see crew there at the start finish. It's like a crew point at mile 80. And then from there, you head out back on another fire road just past start finish. You do two more small loops on two mesas. It's Wire Mesa and Grafton Mesa. And then you're basically in the home stretch to the finish after that.
Yeah, because I know the course has, you know, like, yeah, Gooseberry Mesa, you know, Gooseberry Point, around mile 57 and a half-ish, something like that. You've got that ghost town cemetery. You know, how are you feeling coming into that, you know, 57-ish mile mark?
That's when I had, like, a little, it's like at the top of Guacamole, I think it is, right around there. I was having a little bit of stomach issues. Like I said, I was behind a little bit on sodium, and it was, like, super hot. The sun was just, like, baking everybody. And, like, I was, like, that was the section I was, like, going to try to push on a little bit because, like you climbed up to the mesa, but it was, like, an easy-ish climb on, like, you know, just, like, a dusty service road. And when you're on top of the mesa, it was fairly flat. So I'm, like, okay, I'm going to push up here. But, like, every time I tried to run, like, felt like I had a bunch of, like, fluid in my stomach and it wasn't, like, moving through my intestinal tract. And I was, like, it took me a while to kind of suss out. Like, every time I'd start to run, I got, like, a little lethargic and, like, real burpy. But I decided to take, you know, like 500 milligrams of sodium I carry in these pills just like for emergency. And I like popped one of those to like bump my sodium up and everything started kind of like moving through my track again. And I was able to move that fluid out of my stomach into my intestines. And I was able to start moving after that again. So that finally felt really good. And then it was a nice steady downhill kind of back into Virgin BMX at 70, and I started to, like I said, come back to life a little bit after that.
Yeah, because that's a big point. And then I know, you know, for the next 20-ish or so miles, you've got that Virgin Desert, like you're mentioning. You know, how those next 20-ish, you know, miles, you know, how those miles play out?
I mean, once I got back to Virgin BMX at 70, I felt pretty good because I got to see my family again. They were there like crewing. So I was in pretty good spirits, but like I said, it was starting to get dark. For me in ultras, I always kind of like the dark hours for whatever reason. I feel like time stands still a little bit in the night and you're just like kind of working in your own little box, you know, because you can't really see too much else. You're just like stuck within the glow of your headlight, which is always like, I feel like pretty cool. But yeah, I felt good leaving there until, like I said, I got to that climb that went up to Goosebump Aid Station at 75. So from 70 to 75, I'd say I ran pretty good up to mile 73. And then it was a pretty hard like climb. Again, probably like 1,000 to 1,500 feet in less than a mile. But this one was on more like technical terrain. So you're kind of like, I wouldn't say bouldering, but you're using your hands a little bit and like you're pushing, you know, pushing your knees down with the palm of your hands and stuff like that to get up some of this. And it just seemed to drag on a little bit there. And yeah, my mood definitely turned around once I got to the top of that and had the 5-ish miles of easy road back into that crew point at mile 80. And yeah, at mile 80, I got to see my wife and daughter. My son was passed out in the car, even though he was crew chief. He was sleeping in the car. So
yeah, and then it's like with all of that, you've only got like 20 some miles to go, just over 20.
Right.
But you got 20 some miles to go. You know, take me into those final miles. You know, how'd those final miles go down into the finish?
Well, I always think the last 20 miles is like the hardest because I feel like you're in it far enough. Like there's no way you can drop now. And then, but at the same time, you still got like 20 miles to go. So yeah, I left the aid station there and I'm like, okay, it's or the crew point at mile 80. I think you had like 1.9 miles to the Grafton Mesa aid station. So that was kind of cool to see people again. But then you had like another 1.9 miles to Wire Mesa. And once you got to the aid station there at Wire Mesa, you had like a 7-mile loop out there out on that mesa. Grafton Mesa was the last mesa. That one wasn't too bad. Had a little bit of climbing in it. But Wire Mesa really kind of like stole my soul there towards the end because it's like 7 miles and it just never seemed to end. And it was kind of like in those dark, hard hours. So I was definitely happy when that one was over with. So. And that one was probably the toughest loop for me, like mentally and everything, because I was kind of like doubting if I was like going the right direction there for a while. And I like, kept making excuses to like stop and look at my watch and look at the map and stuff like that, even though I was like pretty sure I was on course. But yeah, I just struggled with that one the most, just because it felt like I was on top of that mesa for quite a while. And like, you know, you're so close to the finish, you just kind of wanted to be over at that point. So I was really happy when I got that loop done and I rolled back into that mesa. Because from there I was just like kind of backtracking down the trail and knew I just had one smaller loop to do. So in my mind, I had it laid out exactly what I needed to do. And I felt like I was able to like calm down a little bit there and just like settle into the last little bit. I was trying to do some math and, you know, I was trying to finish under 24 hours. And I felt that was doable if I stayed on like below a 15 minute pace. So I was just trying to like focus on that the last like, you know, 5 or 6 miles. And that kept me focused. That kept me focused to get to the finish.
Yeah. And what did it feel like to cross that finish line?
It was pretty good. Normally, like my daughter and I have this thing where we cross together. But she was like passed out in the car. So I was like, I heard like the aid station, or not the aid station, the finish line. So I guess the aid station, but I kind of heard it. And I, you know, it was kind of cool because you saw people leaving that 80 mile point to head back out on like Wire Mesa and that. So you're kind of passing people on that road. So it's kind of cool to know that I was almost there. Like you're seeing other people come and like, they're, you know, they're telling you you're almost there. And I'm like, you're not, like you have a ways to go yet. So it's kind of fun just having like conversations back and forth with people there and like knowing I was getting close. And then like when I came around the corner, like I saw my wife pop out, and she's normally pretty good about spotting me because I always have like a waist light and a headlight, so I have like two lamps on. She's like, is that you? I'm like, what, is that you? Like I was kind of like delirious. She's like, you're like 20 minutes ahead of where I had you. I'm like, well, come on, I'm about ready to cross. So it was kind of a good feeling, like to, you know, see her pop out and jump right out as I was crossing the finish line. And I'd say it was pretty exciting finish, but there was kind of like no one around the finish line. I just kind of like crossed the finish line. Some lady handed me like this mallet to hit this gong that they had there. And that was kind of cool. I think I hit it too hard, and it was pretty loud there for a minute. So, but it was a pretty fun finish. And then I kind of like shuffled over. They said, oh, go over there and pick out your belt buckle. And that was probably the coolest part of the finish, because their belt buckles, there's no two belt buckles that are the same in this race. And I guess they're all handmade from debris that has been like gathered from the course. So they take the debris and like lay it inside the belt buckle, and then they like epoxy resin over top of it. So yeah, just looking through all the different ones to find which one like spoke to me the most was kind of fun when you're kind of delirious, like finishing the race, and looking through all the belt buckles was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. That was one of the cool things. I heard you mention it earlier with picking out your belt buckle. How hard was it to choose which one?
I think I decided like I wanted three different ones and then changed my mind twice. And then the lady's like, look, if you come back in the morning and like, or later today and want to swap it out, that's fine too. I'm like, but she had like a whole box of like unopened ones. And like, I literally made her take everything. Like, she was so patient with me. Like, literally took out every single one so I could look at every single buckle. So that was really nice of her. And like, the one I did pick out, I ended up sticking with. And, but it was just really cool to see like how they made all the different ones and how cool they were. So it's just kind of a cool thing to have like a unique, you know, a unique buckle that like you get to pick out at the end. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So I guess, you know, we can kind of start wrapping it up with, you know, what was the good, the bad, and the ugly out there for the Zion 100?
Oh, I probably knew you were going to ask this question. I didn't really think about anything. You know, I always feel grateful for having the ability through my work that allows me to travel to these races and train as much as I do and have the flexibility to like balance like my entire like home life, work life, running life, coaching life. So I'm always really thankful for that and to get out in these locations. So yeah, I'm very thankful to be able to have the ability to do that and run. But I think just the unique location of this place was really cool. And being on this type of terrain was a new experience for me. And I like to try new experiences and different things and to push myself. So I'd say that was a good, and to be able to like have my family along with, you know, for the journey. The bad, man, I don't know if I ever find a bad, because I try to be a positive person. But if I were to pick like the bad, I think would be like the top of that, the guacamole aid station, where I was having some of the like the burpee and lethargic issues. But thankfully I was able to like sort through that and, you know, be able to move still swiftly along. And the ugly, man, I don't know. The ugly, the whole course is beautiful, so it's hard to really say anything was ugly. I'd say the ugly was the amount of salt and the amount of dust I was covered in afterwards. because you're so dry, I got so salty and crusty. It took a couple showers to like just chip off all those layers of salt and dust. So yeah, I guess that'd probably be the ugly. And the car car and the equipment was all kind of like just trashed with dust.
Yeah, and I think it's cool like the whole full circle type thing, from racing, coaching, training, the family aspect, the family support for something like this.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that's where I'm like most thankful for, is like I feel like I'm able to move like freely with it all and make it all kind of like blend together and work. So
that's the best way to be.
Yeah, it's a tough balance sometimes, but I don't think I'd have it any other way. So
well, hey, this was awesome.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate you having me on, for sure.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, and if anyone has any more detailed questions that about the course, I guess I'd say feel free to reach out. And or if you're thinking about signing up for next year, I'd strongly encourage anybody to go out there and check it out. So, well put on race and great event. So,
and if they need a coaching training plan.
Yeah, right on, man. Yeah, I'd definitely be more than willing to help anybody with that too.
And boom, there we go. Sweet.
Right on, man. Exactly.
And there we have it for episode 97 with Robert Sturba and his race out at the Zion 100. I saw so many photos on Facebook of the course out there, and holy cow, like this course looks amazing. And with that, hey, so also coming up on the podcast, you know, we've still got that JW Corbett chat. It got pushed back a little bit, but we'll get it done. And we've also got, you know, the funnest 50K. It's a 10K, 30K, 50K. We've got that chat coming up. That race is having its inaugural year. So many cool things. And hey, until next time, happy trails.